This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. How safe is your food? Let's take the meat industry. Kosher and halal meat packers are thought to have higher standards when it comes to slaughtering animals. But a recent raid at an Iowa kosher slaughterhouse has raised some questions about that. And so now some Muslims in Chicago think they have a solution. Monique Parsons reports.
100 miles due west of Chicago, 20 fat minutes from the interstate and the nearest Walmart, Scott Hasselman is standing on his family farm. With his plaid shirt and trucker cap, he fits right into this rural scene. But the young woman beside him is a long way from home.
Just tell him about you being a mushroom grower, Dad.
You're from where?
Chicago.
Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Hasselman's guest is Zainab Khan. She wears a long denim tunic and a dove gray headscarf. No one would bat an eye at her traditional Islamic style back home. She lives a block from one of the Chicago area's largest mosques. But it's a rare sight in these parts. She surveys Hasselman's ducks, geese, sheep, and cows, all roaming together in a spring green pasture.
Can I first ask you how long you've been doing this?
2 years.
Oh, really?
2 years.
Did you ever farm before that?
My grandpa and grandfather were mushroom growers.
Khan is here on business. She's the director of Taqwa Eco Halal, a cooperative that distributes sustainably raised, ritually slaughtered halal meat. Taqwa, the Arabic term for God consciousness, brought in about $14,000 from some 90 families last year. That's a tiny fraction of a multi-million dollar market. Sort of like Jewish kosher law, Muslim tradition treats every animal as a sacrifice. A prayer is recited for each. They must be clean, calm, and facing Mecca before they're hand-killed with a single pass of a sharp, clean blade. Like small, sustainable farming, ritual slaughter is time-consuming, costly, and in an age of mechanized, high-volume meat production, it's tempting for producers to cut corners. Taqwa hires slaughterers to do it right. But Khan says Islam isn't just concerned with how the animal dies, but also how animals and their caretakers live. Strolling around Hasselman's farm, Khan wants to see that he tends his own flock and that his animals are grass-fed and free-range.
So it'd be for next year, you'd want probably 20 lambs, right? Uh-huh.
Here in corn country, his roaming menagerie raises some eyebrows. But this Lutheran farmer says he's here to stay. And working with Taqwa would be more than good business. It would build sorely needed bridges.
There's a big, big divide between rural people. Rural people think city people don't know where their food comes from, which is true.
Yeah. So we have these trays, we've got these freezers, and we have these little white trays, and we've got these tags here. So when we get an order, either...
Back on the west side of Chicago, Khan opens a 6-foot-long Kenmore deep freeze to reveal the fruits of last year's farm visits. Neat bundles of frozen lamb steak and rump roast, tightly wrapped in white butcher paper. Each one is marked with a Taqwa stamp. Because supply is small, co-op members pay a premium, a big one.
Like beef, he has it for $7. You can buy Zabiya Halal for $3.49. Sirloin steaks, you can go for like a $4.40 a pound instead of $14.
Mohammed Yusuf Khan is a slaughterman who owns one of the Midwest's largest halal meat distributors. When he looks over Taqwa's price list, he can barely suppress a smile. Khan says most people simply can't afford Taqwa meat. But he agrees Muslims should demand higher halal standards. He's seen so-called halal inspectors arrive to the job late or not at all.
We were really struggling with the standards.
Mohammed Mazar Husseini is the executive director of the Islamic Society of North America's Halal Certification Program. The umbrella group reached an agreement recently after arguing for years over a national standard. He says Taqwa's commitment to local farms is nice, but in a world of multinational corporations, it's not always practical.
Islam and Muslims is not a monolithic group of people. You know, there are all differences of opinion, and we respect that one.
In the coming months and years, Husseini hopes the ISNA seal of approval will be as ubiquitous as the kosher stamps in American supermarkets. At a recent Taqwa dinner, second grade teacher Heba Abbasi gets ready to try some seasoned lamb with rice. She said her father's cancer diagnosis last year led her to organic food and Taqwa's hormone-free meat.
I purchased different parts of the lamb. My husband and I don't cook a lot with meat anyway, but when we do, it's this, and it's great. It feels good.
At its heart, the Taqwa co-op is about the kinship of all creation. Director Zainab Khan says she simply wants Muslims to think about what's on their plate, to know how it lived, how it died, and how it got there. For NPR News, I'm Monique Parsons in Chicago.
We have a story now about chocolate and a disease that brought it down in southeastern Brazil.
And it's a story about unintended consequences of how a small thing, a fungus, affected two large things, a way of life and a watershed. Taken together, they prove the first law of ecology. In nature, everything is connected. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Bahia in eastern Brazil is one of those lush tropical paradises. Everywhere you look, up, down, sideways, something is growing. This was once the center of the chocolate universe. On a hillside in Bahia, Claudio Desimoni reflects on his role as a major player in the chocolate industry.
I had a very nice, a beautiful farm, in fact. I was a rich man.
The farm meant the world to him. It was thick with short, squat cacao trees studded with pods, brightly colored and football-shaped, the source of chocolate. It was a 500-acre heirloom.
For my family, my grandfather, it starts in 1919.
70 years later, on his watch, disaster struck. A fungal infection swept Bahia, witch's broom, a fungus that attacks only cacao trees. That's the very little thing, a fungus carried on puffs of wind. It made Desimoni's cacao trees look awful.
They look completely different because the plants start dying, almost dying, because all the leaves drop and they are completely brown.
Clusters of dead leaves and stunted little branches looked like, well, witch's brooms stuck on the cacao trees. Desimoni went out with his workers, chopping off infected branches, planting new trees he thought might be resistant. It was like the sorcerer's apprentice. He couldn't keep up. With mist in his eyes, he says, the stress killed his wife. Finally, in 2001, the government declared Desimoni's farm non-productive. That meant they could seize it and give it to landless people.
Now I'm poor, but I was rich.
He doesn't know what happened to his farm.
No, I never more went there. I believe that I can't see the farm anymore.
This very small fungus brought down not only Desimoni. Cacao production across the entire region plunged nearly 75%. Brazil went from being the third leading cocoa producer to 13th, and all because of witch's broom. This same fungus changed something else as well. By destroying the cacao trees, it changed an entire ecosystem. In the watershed that contained Desimoni's farm, the ground is hard and dry in many places. Before the fungus, there used to be more than 1 million acres of lush rainforest here. The soil was moist and absorbent. But with the infestation of the cacao trees, people cut down the forest to make money from timber and pastureland instead. The exposed soil was tamped down by hooves and burned dry by the sun. And with that came huge changes to the water flow. Naylor Calasanz works at the Universidade Estadual de Santa Cruz in the city of Itabuna, on the Cachoeira River. He takes us to his lab to show us what's been happening since the fungus hit.
You're almost there. Almost.
Calasanz has been charting water flow and precipitation in the watershed. He's got the data all mapped out on huge rolls of laminated paper. He pulls one from a stand.
This is one project that we had. We have some equipments inside the watershed monitoring the discharge, the daily discharge, and also the precipitations and temperature and things like that.
Squiggly red and green and blue lines on the graph show what happened when the land changed.
As long as we change it for pasture, the water is not able to enter the soil and just touch the soil and run off.
So when it rains, instead of being absorbed by the spongy soil, the water rushes straight off the hard-packed dirt and into the river. Calasanz's charts show that now there's sometimes no water left in the ground to feed the river during the dry season. There have been days where in the city of Itabuna, the river simply doesn't flow.
And this is causing several problems because Itabuna, they are having problems of water supply for the city.
And all because of a microscopic fungus that attacked a crop, that made a farmer lose his farm, that turned lush dark forests into dried out pasture land, and change the way a river flowed. But people are fighting back.
Do you know this bird? It's called Japu. You see? They are black and yellow. And they are, look, they are coming there.
Former cacao farmer Claudio De Simone is now a manager at a government-subsidized tree nursery. At a stage in his life where he expected to be retired and watching his daughter run the family farm, he's supplying all sorts of trees to local farmers. Fruit trees, and trees whose wood can be harvested sustainably. And the nursery even has some cacao trees that may be resistant to the dreaded witch's broom fungus.
I didn't solve my problem, but I probably will solve the problems of another farm.
The government's aim is to bring the land back closer to the original rainforest. As farmers plant the trees, chocolate may or may not thrive again in Bahia, but the other trees will make the soil moist and spongy. And maybe water will once again flow in the river on hot, dry days. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
And you can find a photo essay on how chocolate goes from bean to bar on our website, npr.org.
This week, many Americans did the unthinkable to me. They stopped eating tomatoes. The salmonella outbreak is what drove people to this horrifying end. And who can blame them when the FDA still hasn't pinpointed the source of the bacteria? Me? I've gone right ahead eating tomatoes with not a moment's pause. To me, life without tomatoes is, well, I don't know what that would be. Tomatoes are not just a vegetable. Okay, fruit. They're not just the stuff of spaghetti sauce and salsa. Tomatoes are a part of life. Even my 2-year-old vegetable phobe, Sophia, loves them. To find out how they achieved this exalted status in my family, I went straight to the source, the tomato guru, Elizabeth Seabrook, my mom.
I remember as a little kid eating homegrown tomatoes at both of my grandparents' house, and then my parents always grew them and talked about them with great relish, and therefore I grow them. I grow them winter and summer.
You know what I love? I love how tomato plants smell.
Well, that's why I grow them in the winter. I never have gotten very many tomatoes in the winter, but the smell of the tomato plants are something that I just love.
There's just a feeling that goes with it, right?
It makes me long for a ripe tomato. Instead of those red plastic tomato-like things that we get in the store in the winter.
And you know how Sophie stands in the backyard now and...
Yep.
Eats tomatoes off your vine.
Yep, and they just drip down her front, yes.
There's something about that that makes me, I don't know, wistful or something because...
Well, I did it with my father. We'd go out to the tomato patch, and he had a great big one. He had a big garden at the back of the house. And he would take me out there with a salt shaker, and he would say, "There is nothing better than a warm, sun-warmed, ripe tomato." And he put a little salt on and feed us. I did it to all of us, all my brothers and me. So a lot of it reminds me of my own parents.
The salmonella scare this week.
Yep.
Over the tomatoes. Have you stopped eating tomatoes?
Oh, never, no. I don't think a day's gone by when I haven't eaten a tomato in my whole life, probably.
It's just not an option. No. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what the FDA says.
Right.
My life does not move forward. Without tomatoes.
Right, exactly.
Thanks, Mom.
Bye.
Bye. That's Elizabeth Seabrook of Annapolis, Maryland. Call us crazy, say we're risking our lives, but we will not stop eating tomatoes. If we did, we'd risk something equally important, our happiness.
This news note... NBC correspondent and host Tim Russert has just died of an apparent heart attack. NPR News will be following this story throughout the day. Stay tuned to our newscasts and news magazine programs later in the day for details of this story, which has just occurred. In the meantime, we'll be talking about tomatoes and salmonella. Yesterday, the FDA admitted that the number of people sickened by salmonella-tainted tomatoes is bigger than they thought. At least 228 people in 23 states have gotten sick from eating suspect tomatoes, according to the CDC. That's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. It's been nearly 2 weeks since the tomato salmonella link first surfaced, and while consumers are cautioned to stay away from certain types of tomatoes, we still don't know the source of the outbreak. And there's a chance we may never know. So what's a consumer to do? The likelihood of you getting sick is pretty small, but statistics don't matter very much if you're headed to the emergency room because you chose the salsa instead of the guacamole. Joining me now to talk more about this outbreak and food safety is my guest, Douglas Powell. He's an associate professor of food safety and scientific director of the International Food Safety Network at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. He also writes the Barf blog, if you want to take a look at that before your next meal, which you might. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Powell.
Thank you.
And I gather you're not in Manhattan, Kansas at the moment. Is that right?
No, we're driving back from Ontario and Quebec doing some work up here, although we're eager to get back because Manhattan got hit pretty good with a tornado a couple nights ago.
Well, I was just going to say, there's even reports, I think, even more recently of tornadoes, but perhaps it'll be interesting or troubling to see what you wind up going back to.
Well, my thoughts are certainly with the people in Manhattan, and we're getting back there.
Okay. Well, Dr. Powell, we're going to talk about tomatoes and safety, but first I have to remind callers that they're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So this whole question of food safety, I mean, there's, what, 200 and how many hundred million people in America today eating how many hundreds of millions of tomatoes, and 228 got sick? Are we a bunch of a nation of nervous Nellies?
Well, as you mentioned in your prelude, statistically, the risk may seem low, and certainly there are benefits to consuming a diet rich in fresh fruits and vegetables. If you're one of the 228, you're not very happy about this. And while there's 228 identified, with salmonella, we generally use a factor of about 38 or 40, so that's how many sick people there are, is 220 times 40. So there's thousands of people sick in this thing.
I see. Is this the kind of contamination that you hear about where they say, well, careful washing of your fruit and vegetables, or maybe if you need to, adding a wash of maybe a light acetic acid situation or something? Is that going to take care of the problem, or is this more serious?
This is a little more challenging. Fresh fruits and vegetables are good for us, but as we've consumed more, it's become apparent that today they're probably the biggest source of foodborne illness in the United States. And the best estimates of that are, up to 30% of the population, 76 million, 80 million people get sick each year. Fresh fruits and vegetables is the biggest source, and the reason why is because they're fresh. We don't cook them, so anything that comes into contact has the potential to contaminate. Now, there's some particular ones that keep popping up, and tomatoes is one of them. And with tomatoes, in past outbreaks anyway, it's been shown that things like salmonella can actually get on the inside. So washing is of limited effect. It's important, but it is of limited effect, and this stuff really needs to be controlled on the farm.
I'd like to invite we don't have much time left today, but if our listeners have a call, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Is there a chance? I mean, is it possible we will never know what happened here, or do you have a guess of what's happened in this particular outbreak?
It's possible we'll never know. When spinach happened in the fall of 2006, the Food and Drug Administration was criticized because they basically took fresh spinach off the market. So in an attempt not to take all tomatoes off the market, they said, okay, if you're from these regions, it's okay. But it's taken a while to sort that out because, whether it's food service or grocery stores, they're buying tomatoes from all over the place. They're mixing them together and putting them out for sale. So it's taken a while to work through the system. I think you're starting to see tomatoes coming back, even as early as today, Burger King announced, and that's because they're saying, okay, now we know exactly where they're coming from, not a problematic area, so we can do it. Meanwhile, the investigative work goes on. How far back they'll get, hard to tell.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick call now and go to Hugh in Oakland, California. Hugh, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Your speaker mentioned what's happening on the farm, which almost never gets discussed. We're hearing about what's happening and what's being done afterwards to neutralize. But where are these bugs coming from? In the spinach scare, the E. coli was traced back, of course, to fertilizer. And cattle that eat what they're supposed to, that is natural grass, apparently based on a program on forum on our local KQED station, we heard at the time that cattle eating grass do not produce E. coli. However, when they're eating grains, they do. Is that possible with the salmonella source of fertilizer?
Hmm. Okay. Hugh, thanks for the question.
Spinach outbreak, actually, the best guess at the source was cattle eating grass. It's a bit of a mythology to think that grass-fed cattle don't carry bugs like E. coli. They're present in 10% of all ruminants, grass-fed or not. Now, with salmonella, there's The main sources are animals, also birds and humans. So when we're on the farm, we try to control water, soil amendments, and that is manure, water coming into contact with manure, and human cleanliness, human hygiene. Those are the main points to focus on.
All right. Well, Doug Powell, it's an interesting discussion, and I thank you for coming along to help us sort some of these issues out. I'm sorry we didn't have more time, but we're going to have to leave it there. So thanks, and nice to talk to you again.
Okay. Thanks very much, Joe.
Douglas Powell is an associate professor of food safety and scientific director at the International Food Safety Network at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Keem Oleski. Nathan Bark is our technical director. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's programs. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. Ira Flatow will be back next week. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.